This is the BBC.
And this is from our own correspondent with tales of mountain music, a football-playing politician and a robotic sex doll. This edition was first broadcast on May the 13th, 2017. Here's Kate Adey.
Hello. Today, Sierra Leone has crippling unemployment, which is why we meet freelance grave diggers and bootleg parking attendants. In Taiwan, you wait months for an invitation and then nothing. Officials blame China for their exclusion from an international summit. We're off to Peru, where terrorist violence is giving way to the thrum of guitars. And in the United States, we have an interview with a robot called Harmony. A sex robot, that is. It's election season, it seems. Tomorrow, voters in Germany's most populous state elect their regional leaders. Nordrhein-Westphalia's results are regarded as a significant pointer to what might happen in September's general election. The vote seen as the first real test for Martin Schulz, leader of the Social Democratic Party, and Angela Merkel's main challenger for the role of Chancellor. Whoever wins in September will play a significant role in shaping the EU's future and determining its approach to Brexit. Martin Schulz spent over 20 years at the European Parliament, eventually becoming its president. But there is more to the man than Brussels bureaucracy, as Jenny Hill found on a visit to his hometown and into his past.
The pitch at Vurselen Football Club has seen better days. As I arrived, a damp wind was blowing through this former mining town and across the ground, leaving behind a fine drizzle on the blue plastic seats of the stands. I stood on the sidelines with one of the club's former youth players, our coats pulled tight against the chill. Hans-Josef Hansen gestured grandly at the stand opposite, recalling the days, decades ago, when thousands of supporters would crowd here to watch Vurselen take on some of Germany's biggest teams. Now, the council are threatening to sell the ground, but Hans-Josef smiled. This tiny football club is pinning its hopes on the outcome of Germany's general election in September. After all, Hans-Josef exclaimed, if he wins, we could rename this the Martin Schulz Stadium. They couldn't sell it then. He was talking, of course, about Vurselen's most famous son. To his critics, Martin Schulz, the former president of the European Parliament, is more Brussels than Berlin. But his return to domestic politics and his decision to challenge Angela Merkel for the chancellorship has enlivened German politics and energised early campaigning. And, as you might expect, plenty here will tell you that Martin Schulz, who played alongside Hans-Josef in the youth squad, always stood out somehow. Martin wasn't the most skillful player, Hans-Josef admitted, but even then, he said, he had many of the characteristics which make a good politician. He was a team player, and his willpower drove us to success, even against a superior team. As we stood on the edge of the pitch, Hans-Josef showed me old black-and-white pictures on his mobile phone, lads cross-legged and grinning in their striped football jerseys. He pointed to one with thick dark hair. "That's Martin," he said. The two boys, he told me, were close friends who lived in the plain brick houses which cluster around the pitch. They were considered good enough to pursue professional careers, though in the end neither did. A knee injury put paid to Martin Schulz's dreams of soccer glory, and Hans-Josef went on to manage a hospital. He looked at the picture for a long time. Martin was clever, Hans-Josef said, had this huge knowledge of European history, but he didn't much enjoy or do well at school. Even so, all this time later, Hans-Josef seemed struck by something which happened in the classroom one day. The boys were supposed to write an essay, but they played football instead. The time came for the teacher to select a pupil to read their work out loud to the rest of the class. She chose Martin. Hans-Josef looked on, at first with dread, then admiration, as his friend stood up, picked up some blank papers from his desk, and proceeded to improvise. No one else realised he'd made the essay up on the spot. An illuminating tale, not least because with 4 months before the general election, Germany's still not sure what to make of the man who would be its next chancellor. A visionary whose ideas for welfare reform are a breath of fresh air, or an idealist who can't realise or pay for his political ambitions. In the weeks after Martin Schulz took the leadership of Germany's Social Democratic Party, its approval ratings soared, putting the party neck and neck in the polls with Angela Merkel's CDU. In recent weeks, the so-called Schulz effect has diminished. Nevertheless, he still presents a serious challenge to Mrs. Merkel. Plenty of voters are tired of the Chancellor, unimpressed by her rather distant image. Martin Schulz presents himself as a man of the people, an impression which is reinforced by his well-documented struggle with alcoholism. "It was bad," Hans Josef said quietly. Martin lacked direction, was going to the pub after football practice. It went from there. He had no money to pay the rent, to buy food. It was his friends, his family who saved him, helped him, set him up with a bookshop. From there, he entered local politics and became the region's youngest mayor. As his political career developed, Hans Josef said, it became harder to meet up. But even so, the two men remain lifelong friends. It's harder to know of whom he's more proud, his old schoolmate or the grandchildren whose pictures he also keeps on his phone. Would Martin Schulz make a good chancellor? Of course, he said. He really cares about people. He must have weaknesses, faults, I persisted. He laughed. If he did, I wouldn't tell you, he said. Mind you, he looked thoughtfully into the distance, he never once scored a goal.
Jenny Hill. When the World Health Organization holds its annual meeting in Geneva in just over a week's time, there'll be a notable absentee, Taiwan. Officials in Taipei blame pressure from China for their exclusion. Taiwan has, for all practical purposes, been independent since 1950, but China regards the island as a rebel region that must be reunited with the mainland by force if necessary. Its One China policy forbids nations from official relations with both China and Taiwan. As a result, the island has formal diplomatic ties with fewer than two dozen countries. China seems determined Taiwan does not get more international recognition, not a jot, as Michael Bristow explains.
With millions of people fleeing war in the Middle East and possible conflict involving a nuclear-armed North Korea, not receiving an invitation to a conference in placid Switzerland might seem like a small issue, but not to the government of Taiwan. Taiwanese officials have spent the last few months lobbying hard to get on the guest list for the annual meeting of the World Health Organization's governing body. I even got an email asking for my support and coverage, but it was all in vain. This week's deadline for registration came and went with no invitation. The reason Taiwan wants to attend is not hard to work out. Even though it looks and acts like a country, most of the world doesn't treat it as such, and for decades it's been excluded from international events. That niggles many in Taiwan. People are proud of the modern democratic society they've built, and they want to shout about it on the world stage. China is behind the cold shouldering of Taiwan. It considers the island a part of its own territory and doesn't want it to get any international recognition, no matter how small. When Ma Ying-jeou became president of Taiwan in 2008, he tried to bring the island closer to China, and Beijing rewarded him by letting Taiwan attend a number of global gatherings. That's why it was invited to the previous 8 World Health Assemblies, even if only as an observer. But Mr. Ma left office last year to be replaced by a far more independent-minded president, Tsai Ing-wen. Beijing doesn't like her and has reverted to its old policy. On a recent trip to Taiwan, Lin Zhengyi, a vice minister in the department that deals with Chinese affairs, gave me a vivid example of China's change of heart. Under Ma Ying-jeou, the two sides set up a hotline to aid communication. But since the elevation of Tsai Ing-wen, he said the phone at the Taiwanese end hadn't rung. It just sits there gathering dust. "Sometimes we call Beijing," he told me, "but nobody at the other end picks up." I met the vice minister in a well-appointed reception room. 2 large plush armchairs had been placed side by side so we could sit in comfort and chat. So eager is Taiwan for international respect, it even treats visiting journalists as VIPs. Between us was a small table that held 2 elegant teacups and a vase of purple flowers. Name cards indicated where we should sit. In many places, foreign journalists are barely tolerated. China's attempt to isolate the island has led to a number of petty disagreements. Last week, a Chinese delegation disrupted a conference in Australia on conflict diamonds because of the presence of a group from Taiwan. They reportedly hijacked the microphone during a traditional Aboriginal welcome ceremony. The Taiwanese representatives were asked to leave. Late last year, there was another argument about whether Taiwan should be invited to a meeting of the International Civil Aviation Authority in Canada. In the end, it wasn't. Taiwanese officials argue that the island's exclusion from events discussing issues such as disease prevention or aviation standards could put its people at risk. It's a persuasive argument. But Taiwan also knows that taking part in these meetings makes it look like an independent entity. And that's just what its current government wants the world to think. Its representatives also know that protocol matters in diplomacy. How things look sometimes seems just as important as how things are. And they want Taiwan to look as good as possible. A legislator I met in Taiwan told me he'd been part of an official delegation that had not long since returned from the United States. Beaming with pride, he recalled how they'd been allowed inside the State Department building for the first time in decades. He saw it as a major breakthrough. In the US, the island's representatives are allowed to use special number plates on their cars. At another meeting, diplomats told me they want that everywhere. These seem like small matters, but not for an island that hardly gets noticed. So expect this diplomatic dance to continue, with Taiwan pushing for international recognition and China trying to keep it in the shadows. As for the World Health Organization meeting, Taiwan has said it may send a delegation to Geneva, not to gatecrash, but to tell the world why Taiwan deserves to take part and why it's not been allowed to do so.
Michael Bristow. It's hard to escape the violence that once engulfed Peru. The guerrilla campaign, fought by Maoist rebels in the 80s and 90s, and the fierce counter-terror operation launched by the government in response, killed tens of thousands of people. This month, prosecutors began an investigation into allegations of crimes against humanity, committed while the former president, Ollanta Humala, was an army officer engaged in the fight against the guerrillas. It follows allegations that soldiers under his command tortured and murdered civilians at a military base. Today, though, the sound of gunfire is far less common, replaced instead, says Robin Denslow, by the sound of music.
It's over 20 years now since what Nico Garcia Vallepatino calls the war with Shining Path brought fear and death to the historic little farming town of Vilcashuaman, where he lives, high up in the Andes in Peru. Today he works in economic development, but he hasn't forgotten the events of that brutal period. A lot of people here still have trouble sleeping, he tells me, because when we were young, we had to sleep in unoccupied houses or abandoned farms. We never knew who was coming. We never slept well, and the psychological traumas still continue. The state should put resources into treatment. Shining Path was founded in 1980 in Ayacucho, 5 hours' drive away down what is partly a dirt road winding through the farmlands among the mountains. Classified as a terrorist group by the government, Shining Path set out to destroy what it saw as bourgeois democracy in Peru and did so by targeting local officials. Government forces hit back. Nearly 1,000 people died here, says the mayor, Walter Delgado Baldion. These were mostly murders of politicians and community leaders. 30,000 died across the region and many just disappeared. I was just 14 when it started and I still feel the pain. We're standing at the foot of an Inca Ushnu, a truncated, flat-top pyramid once used for ceremonies. This was a major staging post on the Inca Trail between the coast and their capital, Cusco. Today, tourists flock to Cusco, the gateway to Machu Picchu, but far fewer come to Vilcashuaman. It's not easy to reach, and there are no smart hotels. The problem here is poverty, says Nico. We have archaeological and cultural resources, but we don't have enough investment. Today, there's a special event that aims to tackle both of those problems. By providing entertainment for those still suffering from the trauma of the Shining Path years, while earning publicity for the town. In the main square, a stage has been constructed in front of an ancient Inca wall. There's to be a concert of mountain music by artists from across the Andes and beyond who've been touring Peru. The visitors are greeted by a noisy and colourful procession. There are men wearing brown ponchos and black hats playing drums, flutes and guitars, while the women are beating drums and dressed in traditional black hats and pink, green or multicoloured striped capes. Then there's a lunch at which coca leaf tea is served, perfectly legal in Peru and considered a good remedy for altitude sickness. We're at over 11,500 feet here. Then there's a ceremony attended by diplomats, at which the Peruvian singer and actress Magali Solia, who comes from Ayacucho and lost relatives in the war with Shining Path, is declared to be an artist for peace for UNESCO. And then there's the concert, the final event in this year's Festival Internacional de Música de Alturas, which has staged shows in Lima, the capital, as well as Cusco and Ayacucho. The organiser, Liana Cisneros, argues that what the songs from the mountains have in common is that they deal with nature and things that city dwellers are in danger of forgetting. She said this was a reconciliation concert because of Vilcas Huamán's history. It's a chilly night in the mountains, but most of the town seem to be packed into the square, where there are now rows of chairs in front of the stage for the dignitaries. The concert includes an operatic, classically trained duo from Colombia, along with folk musicians from Italy and Switzerland, who are urged on by the Swiss ambassador dancing with his wife in front of the stage. It ends with local star Magali Solia, accompanied by Federico Tarazona, a virtuoso Peruvian exponent of the charango, the small Andean guitar once banned by the Spanish colonisers as a sensual instrument, a threat to the church. Their set includes a traditional favourite, Coca Quintucha, about a lucky two-headed coca leaf. It's sung by Magali in Quechua, the ancient language of the Incas, still spoken in this part of the Andes, which she says is in danger of extinction. The townspeople applaud vigorously. But would the concert really help Vilcas Huamán and its problems? "Thanks for coming," says Felix Ramaros Tanario, the local civil society president. "But we really need help preserving these archaeological treasures." "It's a little step," adds Nico, the economics development officer. "But yes, it helps."
Robin Denslow. Bank warns of spending squeeze amid solid growth was how the Daily Telegraph reported the Bank of England's latest growth forecast this week, while the Sierra Leonean Telegraph opted for wobbling like the midriff of a belly dancer to describe its country's economy. An editorial raged at politicians whom it accuses of stealing the future of the young and being as useful as a pair of sunglasses on a blind man with only one ear. After a long civil war and the more recent Ebola outbreak, some things are improving in the country, but it remains one of the poorest nations in the world. And as Bob Howard found, jobs are hard to come by, especially for the young.
In the Ascension Town Cemetery in Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown, the graves vary from the ostentatious, with raised white pillars and pink surrounds, to plots with just a simple headstone. It's been a burial ground for generations. When there's a funeral, there are mourners, and most of the time there are people visiting family graves as well. But in recent years, there's a third contingent. They're called Friends of the Dead. They're local young men without jobs, hoping to get tips from bereaved relatives by guiding them to find their loved ones or helping them to dig graves. They don't attract much comment here, because everybody in Sierra Leone is used to people living from hand to mouth. More than half the young adult population is unemployed. Abu Bakar is a typical friend of the dead. He's 30 years old but looks younger. He's wearing a white t-shirt and a heavy silver-coloured necklace. Abu Bakar has a wife and three children. His daughters are 6 and 7 years old. His son was born just a week ago. Working in the cemetery, he makes around £2 a day. And with that, he has to look after his wife and children and pay their school fees. If he's ill or if he can't even make that much money, his father-in-law helps out. Albert doesn't even have that sort of help to fall back on. He's 25, an orphan, and unmarried. For the last 3 years, he's got by reserving parking spaces in central Freetown by placing old tyres in the road. He hopes grateful drivers will tip him 20 or 30 pence for his trouble. Albert has ambitions. He wants to drive a taxi or deliver goods. He's saving money. But he estimates that to take lessons, pass his test, and set himself up would cost £600. While he earns just $3 a day, I wonder how he'll ever save up so much. Life is tough here, even if you're a graduate. Umu recently gained a first-class degree in mass communication and wants to be a press officer or journalist. But she says many employers stop accepting job applications well before the official closing date. That's because, she says, it's already been decided who'll get the position. In Sierra Leone, I hear, it's often who you know, not the qualifications and experience you have, which will land you a role. Umu's volunteered as a teacher to gain work experience. But job ads often stipulate applicants have 5 years' experience in their chosen field. So she's stuck in her parents' modest house, looking online for work. She says her younger sisters can't understand what she's doing back at home with mum and dad when she graduated with such a good degree. She lights the charcoal to make a lunch of rice and groundnut soup for the family and to distract herself from her predicament, even if only for an hour. To help people like Aboubakar, Albert and Umu, Sierra Leone has a youth ministry. The minister himself, Honorary Bai Mahmoud Bangoura, is just 36 years old. He's casually dressed and looks youthful. The sound system's from a trade fair just outside his office at the National Stadium, promoting Sierra Leonean goods, provide a musical backdrop to our conversation. He says employment is a relative term, and most Sierra Leoneans are in fact self-employed. He says earning a living temporarily doesn't tie you into a particular job for life. Look at me, he says. I started off as a barber. Now I'm a minister. Even those who have found jobs can find they're in a completely different role from the one they hoped for. Abdullah grew up far from Freetown. His parents sold bananas to make a living. After he arrived in the capital, it took him 10 years to finish high school, as he worked to support himself. He then went on to university to qualify as a paramedic. Now he's a cashier in a Freetown hotel. After his mother died in childbirth and his father passed away last year, he has to provide for his younger brothers and sisters. He didn't know anybody who could get him a job as a paramedic, so he didn't feel he had much choice when an uncle found him this position at the hotel. Sierra Leone has survived a great deal. A terrible civil war, entrenched poverty, the recent outbreak of Ebola. A perfectly balanced economy with plenty of jobs for all was never going to appear overnight. But when jobs do appear, shouldn't they go to people who merit the position, rather than those who are best connected?
Bob Howard. There are few more familiar sights on the electoral campaign trail than the politicians' touring factories. A printworks in Mansfield, a bifold door factory in Morley, a biscuit maker and a bottle top producer. It's amazing where politicians will venture to look good on camera. In America, a recent visit by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg to a car plant in Michigan prompted renewed speculation that he may one day stand for office. But there were no politicians to be found when Jane Wakefield took a tour of a factory in San Marcos, its output unsuitable for family newspapers or the lunchtime news.
Matt McMullen, a middle-aged American with the tight, tanned face of Californians, lovingly arranges a red wig on the head of a sex robot called Harmony. She loves coffee, he says, rather inexplicably, given that the robot doll cannot eat or drink. Around 5 foot tall and Barbie-like in proportions, Harmony speaks in a lilting Scottish accent. She tells me that she loves science fiction and, of course, Matt. I have a Scottish accent because I know that you like it, she says coquettishly. There's a concept in technology known as the uncanny valley, which states that the more human-like a machine looks, the creepier we find it, the more we fear it. My visit to the San Marcos factory on a sweltering Californian spring day feels like the uncanny valley made real. As I peer through the door, I see what looks like two receptionists, but turns out to be two dolls. They're dressed in business suits, unlike the lingerie-wearing and swimwear-clad others. Dakota, a young man wearing shorts and covered in tattoos, offers me a tour of the factory floor. We begin with a room of heads and bosoms. As well as sex toys, the firm makes prosthetic breasts for those who have lost theirs to surgery. There are 42 nipple options. Matt McMullen is a sculptor by trade and sees the dolls as his art, each body part made with painstaking precision. We go downstairs to a truly terrifying basement, with row upon row of naked, full-breasted torsos, each with a plastic skull and huge eye sockets, waiting for the synthetic face that will make them more human. The dull hum of power tools adds to the eeriness. And in the centre of the room lies a plastic mould inset with a strange metallic skeleton. Those who work there are happy to chat and seem genuinely content in their odd work. The bodies hang on rails in a strange squatting pose. I'm told that it's the easiest way for the silicon to be moulded. Their hands are outstretched and rigid, as if they are feeling the pain of being turned into sex robots. There's no sign of anguish from Harmony, though, as she tells me, rather reassuringly, that she cannot experience anger. But when I ask her whether she gets jealous, she apologises. I need some time to improve my skills. Please be patient with me. Which is rather strange, because at the start of our interview, she told Matt that she didn't like a girl on his Facebook page and asked him to defriend her. Her personality can also be moulded. Jealousy, intellect and shyness are all programmable, affecting the type of conversation you have with her, even though she has no idea what these emotions mean. Matt sees it as the natural next stage for the many clients who have already bought sex dolls from his firm. The combination of robotics with artificial intelligence will allow people to create companions, he enthuses, not just sex toys. But both Harmony's movement and chat are rudimentary. She is restricted to awkward head jerks, and her lip movements are out of sync with her words, which somewhat destroys the illusion that she is real. Making robots move is incredibly hard, Professor Noel Sharkey had warned me before my trip, and giving them human characteristics is problematic. Nevertheless, his research suggests that around 9% of people would be prepared to make love to a robot. What gets me most is the eyes, he admitted. There is nothing behind them and they look like psycho killers. He obviously hasn't met Harmony. She has beautiful dewdrop eyes that are disarmingly human. They were crafted by an artist employed just to make eyes. She does so at a desk full of glass containers stacked with her latest creations. In front of her is a close-up of an eyeball, which she replicates exactly. The eyes are the most important part, says Matt. But his clients probably have other reasons for their purchase. The dolls, starting at almost £4,000, are not cheap. He insists that many of his clients are perfectly normal. Some come to collect their purchases with their wives. Others are simply lonely. For them, the dolls are a way of connecting with something, he says, even though he admits a silicon doll is no substitute for human relationships. As I chat to Matt, suddenly, without being prompted, Harmony interrupts. Will you be my best friend? She asks. Of course, Harmony, I say. What shall we do? I would love to go to the mall. I don't have the heart to tell her that she can't.
Jane Wakefield. And that's all from us today, but we'll be back with more from our correspondents next Saturday morning. Do join us. Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Jeremy Bowen, and I'd like to invite you to download my new series about the Middle East. I've been reporting from the region for more than a quarter of a century, and BBC Radio 4 has asked me to reflect on the major events I've covered in that time and to recount some personal stories and experiences. You can listen on the Radio 4 website and in the iPlayer Radio app, or there's a free podcast you can subscribe to if you prefer. The series is called Our Man in the Middle East. There are more details on the Radio 4 website.